Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 17th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, top of the fold, Rex readies for new $80 million cancer hospital, by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. A delayed cancer hospital project by Rex Healthcare that stirred some opposition in 2009 could be back on track, with the hospital system looking to sell up to $80 million in bonds to pay for construction. Rex, which is wholly owned by UNC Healthcare, received approval from the state in 2010 to build a cancer hospital on its campus in Northwest Raleigh. Construction was set to begin in the fall of 2011, but was pushed back. The main reason for the delay was an increase in cancer patients that Rex began to see, says Chief Financial Officer Bernadette Spong. The hospital went from seeing 80 patients a day while designing the hospital to 140 patients per day now. We wanted to make sure we had the right size facility, Spong says. That's really what the issue is. Now, the project could go forward with the bond rating agency Fitch Ratings, headquartered in Chicago, affirming its A-plus rating for Rex and noting that the hospital could sell up to $80 million in bonds for the hospital in the coming 12 to 18 months. The bulk of the project would consist of a new construction. It would add more than 71,000 square feet to the complex and result in the renovation of more than 21,000 square feet according to the original plans. Because the design changes are only tweaks, as Spong puts it, Rex will not need to file another application with the state. Jim LeBoon, the primary analyst of the Rex report for Fitch, says Rex is one of the stronger hospitals when compared to similar-sized facilities across the nation. We believe, coupled with the UNC support, good management at Rex is reflective in their financial numbers, LeBrun says, and the service area is fairly affluent. Based on Fitch's median grades for A-plus, minus rated organizations, A-plus rated organizations, Rex's measures are significantly higher than the median. But LeBoon acknowledges that the credit rating agency would have to revisit the hospital's debt structure due to Rex's plan to also build a heart and vascular hospital costing $278 million. We do not have good clarity on Rex's entire debt structure, LeBoon says, adding that he does not think the $80 million debt load for the cancer hospital will affect the hospital's metrics in the short term. In North Carolina, healthcare systems must file a Certificate of Need application with the Department of Health and Human Services Division of Health Service Regulation. After Rex's filing in 2010, some other healthcare providers, particularly in cancer fields, objected to the project. We see an enormous financial outlay for something that will do nothing to enhance the services that we as physicians can offer our patients, said Dr. Alan Kreitz at the time. He is a practicing physician at Cancer Centers of North Carolina, which are cancer treatment specialists with six locations throughout the Triangle. There is absolutely no evidence in Rex's application that the overall need for medical oncology services at Rex will increase over 12% annually, but the success of this project hinges on these unrealistic utilization projections, he said of Rex's projections contained in the hospital's application. Kreitz pointed specifically to the NC Cancer Hospital in Chapel Hill and the new Duke Medicine Cancer Center as providing ample cancer services in the area. Kreitz, who still practices at CCNC, could not be reached for additional comment. Next up, Harold Lichten, as with others, belted by times. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Harold Lichten's commercial real estate realm is dwindling toward naught as a Delaware investment fund attempts to seize two upscale office buildings near the PNC Arena in a series of legal maneuvers. Loss of those buildings would leave Lichten in the Triangle with just some land in Durham and a three-story building near Rex Hospital's main campus where his companies are headquartered. and that building went into jeopardy in February when the lenders moved to foreclose on it. A Licton-owned LLC owed $6.4 million on it as of July, according to TREP, a mortgage data provider. Though he's far from alone in a troubled real estate market, Harold Licton once was one of the most aggressive players in Triangle Real Estate. As recently as 1996, Licton Properties owned more than 1 million square feet of office space. But during that robust market, Licton was able to sell the company to Weeks Corporation, an Atlanta-based real estate investment trust, for $164 million. Licton went on to develop properties both here and in Charlotte, but now many of those properties are entangled in a maze of court and bank proceedings that include foreclosures and lawsuits. On top of that, at least one action is being directed at Licton as an individual as well as at a family trust he controls. Two office buildings on Trinity Road in Raleigh, known as the Palisades, were sold through foreclosure in May and June, and Licton lost at least three Charlotte-area properties that he was involved in developing following a lawsuit by a co-investor. As for the buildings near the PNC Arena, they have been in bankruptcy reorganization since February. Licton Wade, LLC, an entity controlled by Licton, borrowed about $39 million from BB&T Bank in 2007 to build and outfit the buildings. The company defaulted on the loans in late 2011 when they came due and filed for Chapter 11 in February in an attempt to renegotiate the loans' terms with BB&T. But the bank sold the loans to ERGS2, LLC, the Delaware Fund, in March, according to the court documents. On July 27th, ERGS filed a bankruptcy reorganization plan in which it would take ownership of the two buildings to cover the bulk of Licton Wade's debt. As for the ERGS action, bankruptcy judge Randy Dowd blocked that firm's bankruptcy plans following an August 13th hearing. Dowd could revisit the matter if Licton Wade doesn't get a plan of its own approved by mid-November. Separately, ERGS is suing Licton himself and a Licton family trust in federal court in Raleigh, demanding that they make good on their guarantees of the Licton Wade loans. ERGS lawsuit against Harold individually is simply an additional part of the aggressive posture in this case, Licton Wade bankruptcy attorney Trawick Buzzy Stubbs says. ERGS managing executive Craig Boyd in Irving, Texas, declined to comment. The fund's investors are in Florida, New York, and Texas. It has hired a small army of attorneys in Houston, Atlanta, and Chapel Hill to pursue the two Licton Wade buildings. David Warren, who represents creditors as an attorney at Poynier Spruill, LLP, and is not involved in the Licton case, says a debtor generally has 6 months to get an approval for its reorganization plan, and that a court is usually quick to grant it an extension. A creditor gets its crack only after the extensions run out, and Warren says such attempts are somewhat rare. Licton and Stubbs are fighting to keep the two Licton Wade buildings. They've remained at or near full capacity for at least the last year, with high-profile tenants such as law firms Cranfill, Summer & Hartzog and Ward Smith, the Select Group recruiting firm, and the Raleigh office of BDO, the nation's eighth-largest accounting firm. Stubbs says Licton Wade expects to submit and gain court approval for its own bankruptcy reorganization plan, which he says would pay all creditors in full. In contrast, Stubbs notes that ERGS's plan would leave only about $300,000 to other creditors to cover their own legal expenses and nearly $500,000 in claims against Licton Wade. Licton representatives have said the default resulted from the company's inability to refinance the loans in a lending environment vastly different from 2007 and 2008, when the companies went up. Several companies filing for Chapter 11 in the last year have described themselves as being in similar situations. As for the future, a company managed and part-owned by Licton has planned to develop a 96-acre swath of land on Page Road in Durham since late 2000. The company, Arrington LLC, was formally dissolved in April after failing to make an annual filing to the state. Arrington co-investor Dean Painter reinstated the company and now manages it. This week's lead article, Billionaire's Son, How James A. Goodnight is Becoming a Power Player in a Local Real Estate Market, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. Beneath the stucco and marble facade of an old bank building at the corner of Harget and Salisbury Streets in downtown Raleigh, James A. Goodnight has discovered a historical gem. Yes, James A. Goodnight, not a junior, but the 30-year-old son of billionaire SaaS founder and CEO James H. Goodnight. There are a few names with higher recognition in these parts than Jim Goodnight, though the younger of the two goes by James and dad is Jim or Dr. Goodnight. James has faced both positives and negatives with the name and what he says is a hobby, buying up and renovating historic downtown Raleigh properties. He sets up LLCs to do his deals and keeps his name off most paperwork when negotiating to buy a property because, he says, I find that as soon as people put that together, I get these really awful offers. On the positive side, he admits his name hasn't hurt when talking to bankers. But he's not using SaaS money or even Jim Goodnight's real estate investment kitty. Actually, I haven't borrowed anything from them, James says, of the real estate and business investment funds set up by his father, who ranks among the 300 richest people in the world with an estimated net worth of $7.3 billion, according to Forbes. James does work at SaaS in the company's finance department, and that's helped him line up his investment dollars. Because I was in finance, I knew where to find money when a lot of other people couldn't, he says. At this point, I've also got a little bit of a track record doing some of this redevelopment stuff downtown. Goodnight, who lives in a downtown Raleigh condo, says he did consult SaaS's tax advisors about historical tax credits before he bought the Salisbury Street building, but he says he has no other investors in any of his real estate holdings. The youngest of Jim and Ann Goodnight's three children, James Goodnight grew up in Cary, graduated high school from Ravenscroft in Raleigh, and earned majors from UNC Chapel Hill in history and psychology. Since 2008, he's built a portfolio of 5 commercial buildings scattered around downtown Raleigh, plus a few residential properties in the Mordecai neighborhood and on Bagwell Avenue near NC State's campus. He owns both the building that Flanders Gallery occupies at 302 Southwest Street and the building that Rapid Fitness occupies at 800 North Person Street. But what has him psyched now is the building at 200 South Salisbury Street. It's funny to see people that excited about it, Goodnight said amidst the demolition work while walking through the 3-story building, which has a sizable bank vault in the basement. Nobody knows the address until you show them the picture, and then they stop and make a face like they stepped on something. Oh, that one. Built in 1920 for Raleigh Industrial Bank, the building's decorative brick and stone facade in classical revival style was completely covered in 1972 with a flat stucco and marble exterior that was a popular architectural feature of the decade. Goodnight, through one of his LLCs, purchased the building for only $700,000 in July. It was only after he took a sledgehammer to the sheetrock that he discovered that many of the original windows, hardwood flooring, and even the bank's original after-hours deposit box were salvageable. Because most of the original structure is intact, Goodnight hopes he'll be able to recoup some of his renovation cost, which could exceed $700,000, through federal and state historic tax credits. Several property owners in downtown Raleigh, led by Greg Haddam's Empire Properties, have used historical tax credits to offset the cost of rehabilitating dozens of buildings within the downtown's historic overlay district over the past 10 years. Many of these rehab projects have been credited with attracting new businesses, restaurants, and retailers to downtown. Nobody's building up, so you're seeing a lot of redevelopment, reuse of some of this older stuff that's been overlooked in the past, Goodnight says. David Maurer, principal of Maurer Architecture in Raleigh, is working with Goodnight on plans for the Salisbury Street building and says that even with the promise of historical tax credits, buyers of old buildings are still taking huge risk because there will always be surprises when the construction work begins. He has to uncover everything before the State Historic Preservation Office can even see if it's eligible for historic tax credits, Maurer says. But if deemed eligible, building owners can deduct up to 20% of their renovation cost from their federal income tax bill and up to 20% off their state income tax bill. That means for every dollar you spend, you get 40 cents back, Maurer explains. You still have to spend the money, but it's a great deal. David Diaz, president and CEO of Downtown Raleigh Alliance, says Goodnight is part of a wave of young entrepreneurs following in the footsteps of Haddam, who has since 1995 purchased and renovated 42 buildings in the downtown district. There are a lot of young up-and-comers investing in downtown, Diaz says. They see an opportunity to be successful business-wise. But Goodnight says the buying and leasing of real estate remains a hobby for him. At 200 South Salisbury, he hopes he can lease the top two floors of the 8,675-square-foot building to an office user and find a restaurant or retail tenant for the first floor. Brian Wallace, a real estate advisor with York Properties, is representing Goodnight in marketing and lease negotiations for his Raleigh buildings. The best marketing for this building will be when the stucco comes off and people will say, "Where'd that building come from?" Inside the front cover, NCCU makes major curriculum changes, by Jason DeBrun from Durham. NC Central University will eliminate or merge 14 academic programs and add two new degree programs as a result of the most comprehensive academic review by the university in 30 years. The university expects to save roughly $500,000 in program cost with the restructuring. NC Central now will offer 77 total degree programs, including 33 at the graduate level. Most notably, the University in Durham will consolidate the College of Science and Technology with the College of Liberal Arts to form a College of Arts and Sciences. While the university reviews programs, it hasn't tackled such a comprehensive review as this in years, says Bernice Johnson, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Associate Provost. "It was major, but I think the results are outstanding," she says. The university has different reasons for discontinuing various programs. For the Master of Arts in Sociology and the Bachelor of Arts in Public Administration, for example, the university lacks the resources to deliver the level of quality NCCU students deserve to be competitive in the career markets of the future, according to a report on the changes. Elsewhere, university officials identified environmental, science, and geography degrees as having low productivity, according to the same report. In other programs, graduation rates affect the decision more than a lack of enrollment. The computer science program, for example, graduated only 6 students in the past 3 years. "That is not a good record," Johnston says. Students enrolled in that program will be allowed to finish on track if they desire. It is possible that some adjunct professors will not have their contracts renewed, depending on enrollment and demand in remaining programs in the future. Certain chair positions are also eliminated with the consolidation, but those are held by faculty members, so there will not be layoffs initially, says Johnson. The University of North Carolina System Board of Governors approved the consolidation this summer, but coming to this point took a long time. NC Central hosted 6 forums through the fall semester last year, which were attended by more than 800 faculty, staff, and students. "This new structure deploys our resources in a more strategic fashion," former Chancellor Charlie Nelm said in June. "We believe these changes strengthen our academic programming and offerings and position our students for greater success." Interim Chancellor Charles L. Buckton said during NCCU's annual university conference on October 14th, "The changes that will be implemented will help us ensure student success while retaining and graduating students with competitive credentials." Will NCCU look differently? Yes. "We will offer more robust programs that will better prepare our students to lead in a global society." Nelms announced his retirement in late July, a move that came as somewhat of a surprise to many in the UNC system. Becton, a Durham attorney, law professor, and former judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, is serving as interim chancellor for this semester. "The timing of the academic restructuring and chancellor change are unrelated," says Anya Hernandez, a university spokeswoman. Next up, No Bloom off-boom here for multifamily. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Banking on growing demand for apartments, an alliance of two multifamily developers from Virginia and Colorado has paid one of the highest land prices so far this year for commercial property in Wake County, $6.4 million for 9 acres on Blue Ridge Road. The joint venture partners, Woodfield Investments of Arlington, Virginia, and Simpson Property Group of Denver, Colorado, are planning to make the most of the investment, with immediate plans to start construction of a 384-unit luxury-style apartment community called Marshall Park on the Greenway. The first units of the estimated $57.6 million project are expected to open by December 2013, with the project fully completed by May 2014, says Mike Underwood of Raleigh, a co-founder and principal of Woodfield Investments. Bank of America is providing construction financing. Marshall Park joins more than 30 other apartment communities planned or under construction in the Triangle. The apartment market is red hot now, but developers know their business is cyclical and they need to get projects open before demand wanes. One analyst forecast shows that demand, which has been averaging absorption of about 1,000 new units every 6 months, has already started leveling off. At the same time, more than 4,300 new apartment units are expected to open within the next 12 months, with another 9,502 units proposed to being built. According to Engel Eddington, an apartment market analyst for research firm Real Data of Charlotte. Developers are eager to take advantage of current market conditions, but availability of financing remains tight, she says. Just around the corner from Marshall Park, actually, Wells Fargo Bank is negotiating to sell a 24-acre site known as Crabtree Village that is bound by Crabtree Valley Avenue, Blue Ridge Road, and Homewood Banks Drive. A Charlotte apartment developer is interested in building up to 525 apartment condo units on that site, plus a hotel, commercial, and retail space. Development activity is so strong because the region's apartment vacancy rate has been dropping precipitously since early 2010, and the market's average rental rate has increased by 15%, from an average of $751 per month in January 2010 to $864 per month in July. The Triangle region's apartment vacancy rate in July was 6%, lowest since 1999, Addington's report shows. Woodfield's Underwood has been involved in the construction of several large luxury-style apartment communities, such as Chancery Village at the Park in Cary and Woodfield Glen in Raleigh, plus the 255-unit Woodfield Creekstone apartment project opening soon in Durham. He says he's been working on plans for the Marshall project on Blue Ridge Road for more than 5 years. The property, which abuts the Blue Ridge Health Care Center Nursing and Rehabilitation Campus, was previously owned by longtime Raleigh real estate investor Rick Marshall and two other investor groups. I took it through zoning and then 2008 hit and we tabled it, Underwood says. Woodfield and Simpson decided to restart the project again in 2011 and received city approval last spring. One of the biggest challenges for the site early on, Underwood says, was its limited accessibility from Blue Ridge Road. Underwood had been negotiating to buy a 4-acre site that was contiguous to the property and would allow a second access street into the property, but the owner's asking price at the time was too high, he says. By luck, I was driving by there one day and saw for sign sale on the property because it had been taken over by the bank. Underwood says, I was able to buy it for much less from the bank. Wake County records show that Woodfield paid Bank of Hampton Roads $500,000 for the 4-acre lot, or about half of its tax value. The Simpson Woodfield Venture plans to build 24 townhouse units on the site, which will also be available for rent. Rick Marshall says he's glad to see the apartment project finally come to fruition, anticipating that a major draw will be its direct access to the Capital Area Greenway trails nearby. Since 2004, Marshall has donated nearly 12 acres along the Greenway to Raleigh's Parks and Recreation Department. Marshall is also working with the city to build a memorial park along the Greenway and near where Marshall Park will be built that will honor his father, Lieutenant Colonel George F. Marshall, who was killed in action in World War II, while stationed in North Africa. Next article, where the jobs are. Triangle's diverse economy is paying off with three counties topping gainers in North Carolina. By Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh. With diversified economies that insulated them from the full force of the recession, Wake and the counties around it are continuing to create jobs at a faster clip than most other areas in the state. In fact, Wake, Franklin, and Johnston County were the state's top counties for adding private and public payroll jobs in the 12 months ending June 30th, according to data compiled by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The growth rate for each was 4.15%, says the BLS. During the 12 months, the number of Wake residents reporting that they had a job grew by nearly 17,920. Expanding the total from 449,890 in June 2012 from 432,060 a year earlier. The figures included all county residents age 15 years and above, including agricultural workers. The residents' jobs weren't necessarily in the counties where they lived. All three of these are Triangle counties, notes Chapel Hill-based labor market analyst John Quintero, who points to multiple factors to explain the region's performance, including the tech and healthcare industries and the universities. Another reason the area's economy continues to churn out new payroll slots has been a relatively healthy rate of entrepreneurial activity and therefore business creation. In Wake, for example, new business creation has loped along at 3% a year since 2008. Nearly double the national pace of 1.7%, according to PNC financial economist Mikhail Tresholm. For Durham and Orange counties, the number of people reporting they had a job jumped by 2.1% for the 12 months ending June 30th. After the Triangle area, next in line in creating new jobs is a cluster of Triad counties. In Rockingham, for instance, the number of employed persons jumped by 3.29% for the 12 months ending June 30th. Meanwhile, Guilford, Greensboro, and Randolph counties each grew by 3.28%. Not surprising, says Quintero, you would expect to see the most populous counties adding the greatest number of jobs. After the Triad, coastal Washington County added the next highest percentage of workers, 3.02%, during the 12-month period. Next came Castle County at 2.85%, Wayne County at 2.79%, Alamance County 2.76%, Onslow County 2.74%, Union, Mecklenburg, which is Charlotte, Gaston and Cabarrus counties 2.5% and Anson County 2.51%. The relative underperformance of the Charlotte region might be remedied moving forward by the types of jobs the state's largest metro will generate as the recovery catches hold, says Wells Fargo economist Michael Brown. Charlotte job creation will be in the service areas, financial, healthcare, and higher education. And these tend to be more sustainable types of jobs, Brown says. When is that recovery supposed to pick up? The state's overall jobs creation numbers are expected to begin improving slightly through the remainder of the year as unemployment at 9.4% in June improves to around 8.5% by December, projects UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton. And now, poor overseas performance, a drag for Golden Leaf Fund. By Lee Weisbecker. From Rocky Mount. Declines in its portfolio of international stocks and bonds sent fiscal 2012 investment returns into negative territory at Golden Leaf Foundation, a nonprofit established by the state to distribute and invest tobacco settlement millions. In a preview of the group's most recent performance, Golden Leaf President Dan Gerlach says overall returns were down by 0.6% for the 12 months ending June 30th. The drag came from overseas, he explains. The loss was due primarily to declines in stocks and bonds outside the U.S., the worst-performing categories, Gerlach says. That affected everything. Golden Leaf entered fiscal 2012 with nearly 24% of its $793 million investment portfolio in international stocks and stock funds. Created in 1999, Golden Leaf uses investment returns and an annual cash infusion from the National Tobacco Settlement, which amounted to $69 million in 2011, to make economic development grants primarily in the areas hit hard by the downfall of the tobacco sector of the state. The essentially flat investment returns for fiscal 2012, Gerlach says, has limited impact on the organization's latest rounds of development grants, expected to total around $50 million this year. The amount granted in 2011 was $45 million. But if it becomes a trend, for every million in funds not received, you lose that million plus $400,000 in earnings over time, Gerlach says. Investments that returned positive results for the 12 months ending June 30th were private equity, which makes up nearly 11% of the portfolio, U.S. Treasuries, which represent about 6%, real estate, about 9%. Golden Leaf isn't alone. The Arlington, Virginia-based Council on Foundations has been tracking a decline in members' investments results for months. While average returns at U.S. foundations investing $500 million or more stood at 13% for the 12 months ending March 2011, they had dropped to a year-to-date 3.4% as of March 2012, says research manager Terry Ashton. Complete fiscal 2012 figures for foundations as a whole were not available. And now, online sales would be taxed by states under bill in Congress. North Carolina will lose out on $213 million in unpaid sales taxes in 2012, data reveals. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Using negotiations, lawsuits, and even amnesty programs, North Carolina, through the years, has battled, largely unsuccessfully, to collect sales taxes from big out-of-state internet retailers. Now, if rumblings out of Washington, D.C. turn out to be more than talk, the U.S. Cavalry might just charge over the ridge to lend a hand. A committee of the U.S. House of Representatives recently held hearings on legislation that would give states the authority to compel online retailers, no matter where they are located, to collect state sales tax at the time customers click to make their purchases. The hearings have prompted merchants and other groups, including some in the Tar Heel State, to fire off expressions of support. For some of them, the prospect of congressional action would resolve a thorny issue. Bricks and mortar retailers have to collect and remit sales taxes while online merchants don't. This tax loophole currently enjoyed by online sellers has jeopardized local businesses and the jobs they provide, says Michael P. Kirschevel, CEO of the New York-based International Council of Shopping Centers, or ICSC. Enter Congress with two similar bills, the Marketplace Fairness Act in the Senate and the Marketplace Equity Act in the House. Both clarify the online issue by giving states that have simplified their sales tax collections process, as has North Carolina, the right to compel collection by online retailers. Both bills, as written, would exempt small online retailers from having to collect and remit the taxes, and both thus far have been receiving bipartisan support. In the House, for example, North Carolina Republican Representative Renee Elmers has signed on as one of the co-sponsors of online sales tax collection. So has a Democrat Brad Miller, according to the Miller spokeswoman Luann Knipe. Asked to comment on the potential of a legislative move, officials at the North Carolina Department of Revenue punted on the politically loaded question, even as the best available study shows the state will lose around $213 million in uncollected e-commerce sales taxes in 2012 alone. Those losses have mounted despite efforts by the state revenue officials to collect from out-of-state retailers. In April 2010, armed with the new state collections law, dubbed the Amazon tax, revenue officials offered amnesty to 450 leading online merchants, agreeing to forgive past uncollected sales taxes and penalties in exchange for a promise from them to remit payments going forward. Only 27 retailers, or 6%, signed on, though June 30th, those that complied had paid the state a total of $22 million. According to revenue spokeswoman Beth Stevenson. After 26 months, that's only about 10% of the $213 million lost. Stevenson hastens to add, however, that the $22 million figure doesn't include collections from all online sales. Revenue officials don't discuss their ongoing tax negotiations with specific companies. Moreover, a small number of North Carolina tax filers, around 2%, calculate and pay taxes on their own electronic and mail order purchases. It's because 98% don't that the state is forced to turn to the retailers and the point of purchase. North Carolina's 2009 online collections law was based on the notion that, since electronic merchants like Amazon had in-state affiliates with web links to Amazon on their sites, a sufficient nexus existed to compel the online giants to collect and pay the North Carolina sales tax. Amazon and other merchants responded by pulling the plug on their affiliate programs in the state. Amazon currently collects and pays state sales taxes only in those states where it has bricks and mortar warehouses and distribution centers. That's 5 states, and North Carolina is not one of them. Next up, Durham Charity Gets a Match, by Lauren K. Alsange, in Durham. A New York startup has its eye on area nonprofits and is hoping its services will prove mutually profitable. The Durham branch of Meals on Wheels has already tested the services of the company called Catch a Fire. Established in 1975, the organization, which delivers hot meals to Durham County residents unable to prepare their own, needed both a new branding strategy and a new way to showcase its services. But to put professionals in play, Director Gail Adlin said it would cost $80,000. "We just can't do that," she says. With Catch a Fire's volunteer matching service, Meals on Wheels paid less than $4,000 by utilizing regional professionals, including Raleigh-based photographer Kathy Foreman. Foreman donated her service but didn't come away from the experience empty-handed. "It's a really good thing, especially if you're matched with something your soul kind of speaks to," she says. Matching is what Catch a Fire does, but it's not free. Catch a Fire is a for-profit company. Its rates vary, but nonprofits can pay Catch a Fire $250 for a small project, $500 for a medium project, and $1,000 for a large project. The fees fuel Catch a Fire's operations, nonprofits get discounted services, and business owners find pro bono work that matches their ideals. Catch a Fire CEO Rachel Chong was a graduate student at Duke University, where she met Chris Gergen, who is now executive director of entrepreneurial support agency Bull City Forward. He's now an advisor to Catch a Fire, which Chong founded 3 years ago. "People desire to give in a way that's relevant to them," Chong says. "For example, it's fine if a web developer chooses to ladle soup at a soup kitchen, but he or she may prefer to design a website for the soup kitchen." Catch a Fire was launched with equity funding, more than $500,000, according to security filings. The first matching was done in New York City, then Boston, and now Durham, where 11 projects have been matched for 7 organizations. Another 12 projects are in the process of being matched, says Adrian Schmoker, business development manager for Catch a Fire. "There are increasing numbers of people who have bold ideas for positive change," Gergen says. "It's great to be able to connect them to resources like Catch a Fire." Next up, stymied after 10 years, Raleigh Pharma now taking on debt. COPD drug has progressed, but more costly trials are ahead for 10-year-old Biomark. By Lauren K. Alsange. From Durham. Pharma startup Biomark, already betting millions on its lung treatment, is upping the stakes with a $2 million debt financing round. The company, which has raised more than $18 million in grants and equity to date, just completed a Phase 2A trial. Now that the correct dosage for its drug has been established, another trial is needed, says founding scientist Keith Adler, a Ph.D. in cell biology. To do it, the company has taken on its first debt financing round, but so far the round has come up short, with just $266,446 of a targeted $2 million raise. Adler, who created the technology behind the company's lung drug at NC State, has $750,000 of his own money invested in the company. "At this point, I have not made a nickel from Biomark," he says, "and no one will if the drug doesn't reach market. Selling the company is the only way," Adler says, "he'll be able to profit from the technology," but he declined to say whether that was in the works. CEO Indu Parikh, who took the reins after departing CEO Alan Gant retired last year, says debt financing is a faster option this time around. He says the company is actively looking at all finance operations and options, but that selling the company is probably not an option right now. Among those who have invested in Biomark since 2002 founding are former Biomark and Glenraven CEO Alan Gant, former Goodmark Foods CEO Ron Doggett, and Raleigh investor Kennedy O'Haron, according to U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filings. Biomark's technology, as well as the company name, surrounds a protein called the Marks protein and Adler's discovery that it's involved in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. "In human lung disease, we have excess mucus and excess inflammation," he says, adding that the peptides he discovered block the Marks protein from instigating those symptoms. Biomark's inhalation drug candidate is currently being tested on patients with chronic bronchitis. "Right now, there are no drugs that specifically block mucus and inflammation for chronic bronchitis," he says. "There are other treatments, such as bronchial dilators, that cause the muscles surrounding the airways to relax. They offer a little bit of relief," he adds, "but they do not directly target the mucus that interferes with the ability of chronic bronchitis patients to get oxygen. Steroid treatments are also prescribed, but haven't been as effective as needed," he says. Biomark faces huge competition in the race to develop a COPD drug. John Walsh, president and co-founder of the Washington, D.C.-based COPD Foundation, says the pipeline of such drug candidates is as full as it's ever been. "There are probably 8 companies working on multiple products," he says, adding that many of the technologies are very similar. "For now, the market is dominated by pharma giants including AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, and Merck, that market products to ease the symptoms of COPD under the brand names, respectively, of Symbicort, Advair, and Singulair." Data research from Data Monitor Research released a report in November projecting the market for COPD products will grow to $9.6 billion by 2020. COPD is the third leading cause of death in the U.S., according to the American Lung Association. And it's an even bigger problem globally, ALA Chief Medical Officer Dr. Norman Edelman says. Dr. Barry Make, lung expert at Denver, Colorado-based National Jewish Health, says a drug that could treat phlegm would be tremendous. And now money matters. This article is called A Long, Smooth Ride. Bike shop in business for 34 years now has 3 locations in the Triangle. By Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. Price, competition, and technology have grown tremendously in the bicycle industry in the last generation, but Jeff Hutchinson says a bike dealer's expertise and attention are still the keys to success. Hutchinson started All Star Bike Shop in 1978, selling several brands out of a 600-square-foot space near the intersection of Wake Forest Road and Falls of the Noose Road in Raleigh. It has grown to 3 locations, all considerably larger than the original. And he's preparing to relocate one of his stores to the Quail Corner Shopping Center to a larger 4,000 square foot space with a better layout. Now at 34 years into the business ownership, Hutchinson says some of his employees have been with the company for nearly its entire history. Nearly all are full-time. Our store manager, store mechanic, both have been in it for 30 years, he says. A lot of experience comes with that. He says some of his competitors rely heavily on part-time workers. The stores have 17 total employees, Hutchinson says, and business can get hectic when someone is out for vacation or illness. He's looking for a couple of mechanics to handle service, a segment which provides about 15% of the company's total revenue, which approaches $3 million annually. I'd rather be understaffed than have the wrong people, he says. Like most shops, All-Star sells dozens upon dozens of bike models. A few go for more than $4,000. At those prices, particularly, customer satisfaction is paramount. Raleigh resident Larry Adcock, who rides about 3,000 miles a year, says he researched top-of-the-line road bikes for months before buying a $5,000 model from All-Star in November, a new Giant brand bike with a carbon fiber frame and electronic wireless shifting system for gears. The top choice of the shop, was as important as the choice of the bicycle itself, Adcock says. A Raleigh native, Adcock says he knew of All-Star for more years than he knew before buying there for the first time in 2009. Prices of $500 to $2,500 are more typical at All-Star, Chapel Hill-based performance bicycle, and other specialty bike shops. At the lower end of that range, price has become a major factor for buyers at specialty shops as it has at general sporting goods and discount stores, where bikes typically go for less than $100. Hutchinson says his stores dropped Trek, a leading brand for mid and high-priced bikes, several years ago, as its buyers grew more heavily focused on price. All-Star now distributes for just two manufacturers, Specialized of Morgan Hill, California, and Giant, a Taiwanese company. Nearly all major bike producers have moved their manufacturing to Taiwan and China to take advantage of lower labor costs. Meanwhile, the number of specialty bike shops in the United States has dwindled from nearly 6,200 in 2000 to fewer than 4,200 in 2011, according to the National Bicycle Dealers Association. Retail sales have held steady in recent years at about $6 billion, according to the association. It's a business for enthusiasts, and Hutchinson's route is similar to those taken by the owners of the bicycle chain, Flythe Cyclery, and several other local shops. He was an avid road cyclist as an undergraduate at East Carolina University in Greenville and worked at shops there and in Durham. He later helped his boss open a new John's Bike Shop on Western Boulevard in Raleigh. John's went out of business in 1976, Hutchinson says, and he went into business for himself soon thereafter. A second location opened on the north side of Cary in the early 1980s and has since moved to Ridgewood Shopping Center on Wade Avenue in Raleigh. The third location, which is incorporated separately and which Hutchinson co-owns with two partners, opened in Cary in 1990. Hutchinson hasn't mapped out an exit strategy, but he says he'd eventually like to ease out of ownership and continue to work in the stores part-time. One option, he's looking into selling one of the Cary partners. The one option he's looking into is selling to one of the Cary partners. And now from this week's opinion page, from the editor's notebook of Sugata Mukherjee. Did you know who owns that business? With the presidential election looming and members of both parties going full force to get the immigrant vote, a new study by the Washington, D.C.-based Fiscal Policy Institute reveals these immigrants may mean more than just one vote. They are gaining in power and influence, and often they are likely to play the role of fundraiser, given their wealth, status, and connection. Just how do we know that? The FPI study states that 18% of all small businesses in this country are now owned by immigrants, up from 12% just 20 years ago. That percentage is higher than the immigrant population makeup, which is at 13%. But interestingly, most are not in technology, manufacturing, or software businesses. They are in the service sectors, ranging from physicians to real estate agents. About 37% of the nation's restaurants are owned by immigrants. More than 37,000 physicians practice in this country are owned by immigrants, the second largest number of businesses, second only to restaurants. When it comes to North Carolina, FPI estimates, based on 2010 American Community Survey data, that a little less than 9% of the state's businesses are owned by immigrants. Estimates peg the number of those businesses at 13,392. 15th highest among the states. Immigrants are playing a particularly important role in the kinds of businesses that bring people into downtown areas and help enliven neighborhoods, says David Dice-Kaliak, director of the Fiscal Policy Institute's Immigration Research Initiative and author of the report. I don't think immigrants are super entrepreneurs, but I do see that immigrants are playing an important and growing role across the American landscape. And it's not just traditional immigrant gateways. It's all around the country. But there may be one big misconception when it comes to the difference between immigrants that have their own business and the ones who are working for someone. The majority of immigrant business owners do not have a college degree, Kaliak says. The focus on highly skilled immigrants is not misplaced. Immigrants with high levels of educational attainment, are indeed more likely to be business owners. But it is a mistake to overlook the fact that the biggest number of business owners, among both immigrants and U.S.-born, do not have a college degree. This week's guest column is by Mr. Mark Tepper. Mr. Tepper is president and founder of Strategic Wealth Partners in Seven Hills, Ohio. The keys to exiting your startup. Thinking about starting a business? You might as well ponder your potential exit strategies at the same time, even if you plan on running your company for a lifetime. The reality is that most entrepreneurs don't begin to plan their exit until an economic or life event forces their hand. Neglect that can sabotage the return on a life's investment of ideas, time, energy, and capital. Typically, successful entrepreneurs pour countless hours into nurturing their business and managing it for growth. Weeks, months, and even years are devoted to developing processes and procedures for running the business, but barely hours or even minutes are spent on developing an exit strategy for the business owner. Failure to plan for a graceful, financially advantageous exit from your business becomes especially problematic when the business's value is a core component of the retirement nest egg. A well-conceived exit strategy can facilitate receipt of the maximum sale price and help ensure a comfortable retirement. Start from square one. As a business's sale is considered, it is important to start from square one. Detach yourself from your role as owner and begin to view your company through the eyes of a prospective buyer. Potential buyers will pay a multiple of your cash flow, typically earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, based on how risky they perceive your business to be. Simply, the more risk, the lower the multiple. Therefore, the two-pronged goal is to increase your EBITDA while simultaneously minimizing risk in your business. It is important to simultaneously develop a financial plan. For many entrepreneurs, the business is a retirement nest egg, so integrating business and personal planning will help to determine the sale price needed to fund a retirement lifestyle. Next, structure the business so that it's independent of you. Businesses that are dependent on the owner become very risky investments once that individual departs. To put this into practice, appoint or hire someone to operate the daily business activities and learn how to govern the company from a distance. Next, document systems and procedures. A how-to instruction manual and running your business can't be in your head. The business needs to be able to run like a well-oiled machine immediately after you're out of the picture. Next, organize your business's financial house. Avoid over-concentration by making a point to maintain a diversified customer base. When a company relies on a significant percentage of its revenues from the one customer, it becomes a very risky business to buyers. Ensure that financial statements have been reviewed and audited and are readily available. It is also important to have a plan to address unpredictable roadblocks such as lawsuits, HR challenges, or accounting issues, which could translate to a lower multiple. And finally, assemble your team. Before weighing any options or making it known that you're in the market to sell, build a team that can guide you through this process. You will need CPAs, financial planners, attorneys, and investment bankers in your corner as you prepare to sell. It's important to put trust and control in the hands of one quarterback who has experience with exit planning, and this person cannot be you. For most entrepreneurs, this is the first time selling a business, so recruiting a seasoned advisor is vital to overall success. Select an advisor who will align their best interests with yours, and the anointed quarterback will act as the intermediary to ensure that the rest of your squad is synchronized. Selling your business can take nearly as much time and effort as building it. Above all, remember that you cannot begin the planning process too early. Minimum lead time to adequately plan is 3 to 5 years. Ideally, you start thinking about your business exit strategy the day your doors open, so that you can properly groom it for sale. As workspaces have migrated towards a more integrated and open environment, the conversations of coworkers sometimes can be distracting. In fact, a report from the University of California at Berkeley found a large number of workers unhappy with the levels of speech privacy. Executives at MIMS Distributing Company, a beverage distributor headquartered off Ebenezer Church Road in Raleigh, found the same problem and went with an unconventional approach. They added more noise. This new noise, however, serves as a way to block the annoying background noises and makes it easier for people to concentrate. For $2,300, MIMS put in a noise generator that has an HVAC-type sound about 4 decibels above the ambient noise level, blocking the distracting sound waves. CEO Chuck Mims doesn't have an estimate on exactly how much more or less productive workers are, but he says for the time being, everyone seems to appreciate the move. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at the TriangleReadingService.org website immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.